I'm going to open this meeting of the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness. Call it to order on February 23rd, 2016. Remind people this is the last day that we can approve of legislation. So we have two measures for public hearing and possible work session. The first one listed at SCR 206, and I'm going to delay taking action on that until hopefully Senator Olson and Representative Huffman are back. There's a Senate meeting going on, committee meeting at the same time. They need a quorum over there. So instead, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1524A.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Members of the committee. Senate Bill 1524A exempts eligible veterans from the annual medical examination requirement that's applicable to medical marijuana cardholders who are assigned a total and permanent disability rating due to a service-connected disability. That is, they are unable to secure or follow substantially gainful occupations, or determined to be 100% permanently disabled as a result of injury or illness incurred or aggravated during active military service. This only applies to the renewal to continue to maintain your eligibility for the card. Of course, they have to have the examination to get the card in the first instance.
Okay.
It was unanimous out of the Senate.
Out of the Senate. Okay. We have nobody signed up to speak. Oh.
We've just had some people drift in.
And if I recall correctly, Mr. Chair, committee members, Representative Huffman was involved with the amendment to Senate Bill 1524 as well.
So
I have to wait for
them. They hear for 1524, they hear for SCR 206.
That's right. So we'll stand at ease on 1524, which means now we can go back to
SCR
open the public hearing on SCR 206. Please.
And this is in memoriam for the honoring the Wright family.
Very good. Thank you for being flexible.
Thank you, Chair Lively and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Montes Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. Delighted to bring SCR 206 to you. George and Jim Wright were classmates of mine at Gresham High School. George graduated with me at Gresham High, and Jim was 2 years behind me. And I got to know George because he loved baseball and was on the varsity baseball team. And I was the scorekeeper for the varsity team, so I tracked the RBIs, the strikes, the balls, the walks, the fly balls, and all those stats. So I got to know the players pretty well, including George. And he was a great person, and it saddens me tremendously that he did not come back from Vietnam. And his brother, 2 years later, did not come back from Vietnam. His father, their father, is 91 years old. We had him in committee and on the floor when we passed it out of the Senate. And he is actually a Navy veteran from World War II. So I can't fathom the loss that the Wright family experienced in the late 1960s when the two brothers died so young. There are only 41 families in the U.S. who have lost more than one family member in Vietnam. You know, Vietnam veterans rarely talk about personal experiences in Vietnam. They talk about the people of Vietnam, but not the battles themselves. I had the honor of flying in and out of Vietnam during the late 60s and found that they might talk about the long flight over the Pacific Ocean and all of that blue that you see. They might have mentioned the humidity when they were getting off the plane. They might talk about the creeping crud or the dysentery that they might have experienced, or the beauty of the countryside from the air. Or they might talk about their Vietnamese first meal. But I find that they didn't talk about their battles and the deaths of their comrades. I have such great pride that this legislature bestows the highest honor and recognition of these two men. And our Vietnam veterans and these two brothers were trying to preserve our freedom, and they died in the Vietnam conflict. Six of my classmates from Gresham High died. They all served our country with honor, and so let us remember these two brothers' service to our nation We all value our freedom and peace, not only for ourselves, but for all people. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alan Olson. I'm a senator representing Senate District 20, which is the heart of Clackamas County. Being on the Veterans Affairs Committee on the other side, it's often difficult to sit and watch the continued parade of bills that go through honoring GIs that have died. It's even more heartfelt when you talk about a gentleman, as the good senator said, that was 91 years old, lost two sons in the Vietnam War, 2 years and 10 days apart. What a tragedy. Two young men, 21 years old, killed in a war that most people forgot about already. It's a pleasure that the folks from Boring, Mr. Steve Bates behind me here, brought this forward so that we can honor these people and give them some form of closure. Yes, it's only a sign on Highway 26, but Vietnam veterans are the forgotten veterans. You know, we had a little different when we got out of the service. We didn't have parades. We didn't have people cheering and screaming and yelling and honoring us back. What we got was, wow, the dirty looks, the things that you just kind of turn your head from. And that's unfortunate because we all went off to do our duty to our country. These two young men did not come back. So I ask for your support to honor them. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Escobar.
Thank you. Senators, where were these boys at when they were KIAs? Do you have any information?
Yes, I can tell you that. Thank you for the question very much, Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar. Let's see. George Nathan Wright was a member of the F Company, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marine Regiment, 3rd Marine Division, 3rd Marine Amphibious Force. He was killed in the Quang Tri Province on May 21st, 1967. And James Elford Wright, he was a specialist 4 in the Army. His MOS was 13E40, a cannon fire direction specialist. And for those of you that weren't in the military, MOS is what our specialty was. I was a 95B40, which was a military policeman. He was assigned to the B Battery, 6th Battalion, 11th Artillery, 11th Infantry Brigade of the Americal Division, and he was killed in the Quang Nai Province in South Vietnam on May 31st, 1969.
Okay, thank you. I want to add a little bit of what the Senator said, that Vietnam veterans weren't supported so much in the field. They weren't supported by their government. They weren't supported by the population, and when they came home, they were never, not only were they not welcomed home, but they were treated poorly when they came home. I went to the San Francisco airport coming out of Travis, and the first thing I was called was a baby killer. The baby killer's home. I'll never forget that. And, you know, it was tough on us. It was very tough on us. In fact, I threw away all my uniforms and my medals when I came home. So I'm happy that we can do this for these people, and I would be honored to carry this bill.
Thank you. Other questions? Anybody have any questions or comments for these two senators? Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you
for changing your time schedule.
No problem.
I really appreciate it.
We're glad to do it. Mr. Steve Bates, please.
Chair Lively, Vice Chairs Boone and Esquivel, I'm Steve Bates, 38-year resident of Boring. I'm here representing the Boring community. I'm also an associate member of the Vietnam Veterans of America. We thank you for hearing this resolution today, this being the last day to move legislation. On Thursday, February 11th, the close of the House morning session, Representative Bill Kenemer made reference to this resolution and introduced to the House of Representatives my Boring neighbors, Mr. George Wright and his daughter, Sherry. Mr. Wright is a World War II Navy veteran, and I do believe he's had a birthday. He's 92 now. Mr. Wright lost two sons, 2 years and 10 days apart in South Vietnam. Marine Private George Nathan Wright in 1967, and Army Specialist 4 James Alfred Wright in 1969. The people of Boring found this out, and we felt very poorly that we really didn't know that we had a resident that lost two boys in Vietnam. It's bad enough to lose one, but to lose two. The Vietnam Veterans of America visited with Mr. Wright, and he gave us permission to honor his sons. As a result, the people of Boring will be seeking permission and working with ODOT upon passage of this resolution so that we can have a Vietnam Hero Highway on Highway 26. One sign will be for Marine Private George Nathan Wright, eastbound. Another sign will be for Army Specialist 4 James Alfred Wright, westbound at mile marker 19. We ask that you move this resolution with a due adopt recommendation so that we can honor this family while there's still time that their father is still with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bates, and thank you to all the citizens of Boring for taking this cause up. Any questions for Mr. Bates? Great. Thank you again very much. Anyone else who wishes to offer testimony on SCR 206? Not, I'll close public hearing, and I'll open a work session on SCR 206.
Chair Lively, I move SCR 206 to the floor with a be-adopted recommendation.
Representative Boone moves that we moves SCR 206 to the floor with a be-adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, please call the vote.
Representative Evans?
Excused.
Representative
Hoffman?
Aye.
Representative
Parrish?
Aye.
Representative Luzzo?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Aspel? Aye.
Chair Lively?
Aye. Motion is adopted to move SCR 206 to the floor. Oh, carrier. Representative Escobar, you volunteered, would you?
Yes, sir.
Carry it, please.
You.
You're welcome. Okay, now we'll go back to back into hearing for Senate Bill 1524. So nobody has signed up. Is there anybody that wishes to offer any testimony on Senate Bill 1524?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
We have two gentlemen here from agencies that could be available to answer questions.
Question?
They helped write the amendment language for it so that we would get it exactly right. Andre from Oregon Health Authority, medical marijuana program, and then Mitch Sparks from Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Cheyenne can probably introduce the bill, and then I can answer questions too if
we've already introduced the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative, when you were testifying to the committee, we put down the record in the summary. So.
Right. So would you like to make further remarks about the bill, since you're intimately involved with it? Or?
Just on behalf of a constituent, it was a two-part thing. Last year, we were able to take care of the first part of it, the annual medical marijuana card fee in rural through Oregon Health Authority, thanks to Andre and his team. And this one needed a statutory fix, and it was actually narrowed a bit from what we were thinking last year, and I think that's a good thing. So just appreciate everybody's support.
Sure. Any other questions, Representative Boone?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree. I have a few constituents who have been following this closely, and I forwarded all my phone calls to your office just in case they were upset. Just kidding.
I'm here for you, Rebecca.
They're very happy about this, so thank you.
And that brings up a point. You said a few, and I think we all agreed we don't know exactly what the population affected would be, but we do believe it is fairly small.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So I was a no on this bill in the last session. I will be a no again today. It's just a personal moral ethical conflict that I don't feel personally that marijuana is the way to be treating things like PTSD, and appreciate that others want that choice and it'll pass without me, but I'm just going to have to know again. So
thank you.
Representative Escobar.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm in the VA system, and I'm required to be there at least once a year. So these people are getting a full examination at least once a year. So I guess I don't see the problem to the need. Because if they go once a year, they go once a year.
Mr. Chair, yes. Representative, is that a question? I mean
it's
to explain why?
I just know. I have to go once a year in order to stay in the system. If they're disabled, then they're going at least once a year for a complete physical exam.
This population of permanently and totally disabled, you can rest assured that they are probably before their primary care physician or specialist in the VA system at least once a year, if not once a week. And the challenge here is because the way the medical marijuana laws are written, you have to have a statement from a physician, and the federal VA doctor can't.
Exactly.
That's right.
Okay. I forgot about the
Any facts. Other questions at this point?
Yes.
Okay. And no one else testified? I'll close the public hearing on SB 1524A. And open a work session on SB 1524A.
Chair Lively, I move Senate Bill 1524A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boone moves Senate Bill 1524A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Evans?
Excused.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
No.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Esquivel?
Aye.
Chair Lively?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Huffman, are you going to be carrying this on the floor?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Okay, I don't think we don't have any more bills.
I really thought Representative Parrish was going to argue for that honor to carry it, but I guess.
I think not, but nice offer.
Lucky I'm not speaking out against it on the floor.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add that another one of those 42 brothers was in Southern Oregon in Medford, the Rowdens. They lost two boys, and they came to get the third boy as a draftee into Vietnam, and the parents refused. And that kind of started a precedence from then on because they thought, you know, we'd given two sons, we're not going to give a third.
Right.
And so, and they were successful. The third didn't have to go.
Very good. So, members of the committee, that's the last of the business we're going to be conducting for official business for bills and measures for this session. So thank you for your attention and willingness to work on it. Uh-oh, did I miss something, Representative Parrish?
We have bills colleagues on the other side that are stuck, not moving as fast as we'd like them. I would hope that we would all track those things and push on our friends whoever you have good relationships with on the Senate side, because there are bills parked that were veterans' bills that aren't seeming to be getting scheduled for hearings on the other side, and we should certainly be urging our Senate colleagues to push on them. So
it's true. Thank you. Okay. So at this point, we're going to go into an informational meeting, and the first one, we're going to be discussing Seaside School District. And we've had some conversations previously about the Seaside School District and some of the issues they have faced. And so I don't know who, Doug, you're going to speak, and then whoever else, whatever order you want to speak them in.
Thank you, Chair Lyman.
Sure.
There is a presentation that we have.
Absolutely. And just make sure everybody introduces themselves for the record. And
Mr. Chair, if I may, while they're getting settled, welcome my constituents from Seaside, Dr. Dougherty, and who will be retiring, he claims, at the end of this year. But we're going to keep him busy, and he's going to be working with these students. And I also have a student in the back, Anna Keim, who's been shadowing both me and Senator Johnson today. And yesterday I had my granddaughter here from the Seaside High School, and they're all busy working with this program. And we are so excited because you guys, it's for you, and you're people who come up after you and your siblings or your friends, et cetera. But it's very important, and I've been working on, I think, emergency preparedness ever since we had the Ocean Policy and Emergency Preparedness Joint Committee with the Senate back in 2005. And at that time, people were saying, oh my God, don't talk about it, it's so depressing. And we're thinking, yeah, talk about it, it's so depressing. And we have tried very hard, and they'll tell their story, but I am so proud of you guys for doing this. And you can work on it even after you graduate. So, and I know Dr. Dougherty is, that's kind of a hard thing to say.
Dougherty's fine.
We'll be there for you too, as will I, because I hope to continue my work in this committee and on this subject, so. And you are my reason for doing the Oregon Resilience Plan and what we're getting an Oregon Resilience Policy Advisor in the governor's office. And as soon as that person is hired, we are going to hit the ground running, and you will probably be called on to come and present to some other groups here and there if you don't mind doing that. So, welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Chair Lively, committee, thank you again for inviting me back. And as you can see, I've brought some reinforcements, and I'm Doug Dougherty, superintendent of Seaside School District, and instead of me introducing the group, they have sort of a plan to introduce themselves, and Nathaniel Ward, if you don't mind, I'm going to have you begin.
So, hello everyone. Like Dr. Dougherty said, I'm Nathaniel Ward. This is Kina Lynn, Claire Ogilvie, and Kara Ibsen. We are students at Seaside High School, and we're here to talk to you today about the dire situation which we deal with every single day. The video you see playing right over here.
Okay.
This is a video playing. It's a simulation of the evacuation route which our school has to take to get to our safe zone. It was sped up just a bit to fit the time of this presentation. And you'll see throughout the presentation where we are at what time we need to be where we are. It shows you the route and the time it takes to get our safe zone in the best circumstances. So keep in mind, it wasn't raining, the bridges were intact, traffic was flowing and stopping for us, and we left a school that was still a school, not crumpled cement. Also, we are all generally healthy, young, and not disabled. Being a student at Seaside School District is a privilege. Being only 200 feet away from the ocean, we get to see, smell, and hear the ocean from our classrooms daily. However, that privilege comes with a scary reality that looms in our minds every single day. A student, we not only have fire drills, like all schools, but we have tsunami drills too, at least 3 times a year to prepare us for the inevitable. As a grade school student, I remember thinking about tsunami drills and thinking about it as a way to get out of school. But as a high school student, the reality of what those drills mean has become a daunting fact for all of us. It is no longer if the tsunami happens, but instead when, how, and where. It is our mission as student body officers to create awareness around this dire situation which we are currently in, and hope the public will see the need to move 3 of our 4 schools out of the tsunami inundation zone sooner rather than later.
The situation we are ultimately preparing for is an earthquake of at least an 8.7 magnitude, followed by a devastating tsunami, all caused by a fault break known as a Cascadia subduction zone. You may have seen the article in the New Yorker magazine titled The Really Big One by Catherine Schultz, where she basically spells out it's not if this happens, but when. This fault break is caused by one tectonic plate diving underneath another and slowly building up pressure over centuries, eventually violently snapping back, causing a very large earthquake, much like the 2011 quake in Japan. The last Cascadia event occurred in 1700. It is estimated that waters will reach 80 to 100 feet in elevation. That's as tall as an 8 to 10 story building. The tsunami will move at speeds of up to 500 miles per hour towards the shoreline. Once it reaches inland, the water will slow down to 30 miles per hour. But that's still faster than Usain Bolt, who is technically the world's fastest human. The scenario is catastrophic, and it will leave coastal towns in southern Canada, Washington, Oregon, and Northern California with only about 15 to 20 minutes to evacuate to higher ground. The odds of the Cascadia event happening in the next 50 years? 1 in 3, which means it's a very high probability that this will happen sooner rather than later. The bad news is, statistics show that among natural disasters, tsunamis may be the closest to being completely unsurvivable. That is a stat we are fighting against today.
Seaside. Seaside, along with other surrounding communities, are in the worst shape, but the entire coastline of Washington and Oregon are in trouble as well. When the earthquake and tsunami hit, it is predicted that about 13,000 people will die. That's close to the capacity at the Rose Garden Arena in Portland or the population of La Grande. Another 27,000 people will be injured. This is in addition to the 1 million people that will be left homeless and needing shelter due to the drastic land drop in elevation. And unfortunately, due to the complete unpreparedness of the entire coastline, it's very possible that all of those people who have survived will be left stranded without any help for 2 to 3 weeks. How many of you live east of I-5? Here's something to think about. When disaster strikes, all those displaced people will come flooding in your direction, all up and down the I-5 corridor. The populations of your towns are going to increase dramatically. It is assumed that Redmond will become the new Portland, and since the earthquake will most likely destroy Portland and all of the buildings that are not up to earthquake code. Another thing to think about is that Oregon's one and only fuel source sits on the edge of the Willamette River on sandy ground that will wash away and take all the fuel with it. And without fuel, transporting supplies will be impossible.
So the Cascadia Inundation Zone is anything below 70 feet of elevation. Seaside and many other coastal towns are at sea level and definitely below 30 feet. With that being said, after the quake, our roads will be impassable by anything but foot, which would be a long, treacherous journey. If we get out of the school building, the first obstacle will be crossing the river because the bridges will crumble. Now, three of our bridges in Seaside have been retrofitted to hopefully withstand a magnitude of 6.0. Problem is, the Cascadia's lowest possible earthquake is estimated to be an 8.7, which is about 11,000 times stronger. That being said, our bridges will not withstand the Cascadia event and thus create a much bigger problem for the people to get to higher ground in 15 minutes. So you may be saying to yourself, just swim across. Like, that seems like a pretty legitimate option. Until we researched and we found that when this earthquake happens, all of the water will drain from the rivers. The mud or sand will go through liquefaction and essentially turn to quicksand, and frantic people running to water's edge to swim across will be swallowed up by the earth. So it literally will become a survival of the fittest scenario. Those that are physically capable of maneuvering the rubble have the greatest chance of survival.
However, they won't even have the chance at crossing the river unless they get out of the school building that is not up to code for a magnitude 6.0 or an 8.7 earthquake. The high school was built in 1959, and there have been some updates done in the 90s, but those updates will not help in our situation. We need new schools if the kids in Seaside have a chance at survival. In Oregon, there are 4 schools in jeopardy. 3 are in Seaside, and 1 is in Neocony. For Neocony, they actually have a hill right next to them, so they can evacuate towards in that instance. For us, our situation is not so lucky. As we stated in the beginning, our high school students have to travel at least a mile at sea level before they start getting any elevation. Our middle school students over at Broadway Middle School, they have to travel about a quarter of a mile at sea level and then 3/4 of a mile uphill. However, they too need to cross a river and a bridge and are in the same situation that Nathaniel talked about earlier. That particular bridge has not been retrofitted to withstand a 6.0 earthquake. The most dire situation of all is one of our 2 great schools, which is Gerhardt Elementary School. They only have about 1/4 of a mile to evacuate towards their designated spot. However, they evacuate toward the ocean. When they get to their designated spot, the highest point is only 42 feet above sea level. And as we stated earlier, the predicted safe elevation is a minimum of 70 feet. These kindergarten to fifth graders are currently holding evacuation drills that won't even help them potentially survive this earthquake, this tsunami that is predicted. It's truly a gut-wrenching situation when you stop and think about it. With that said, there are precautions and preparations being taken right now in the event that one of these earthquakes strikes. Individuals all over the coast have planned out emergency evacuation routes and keep emergency backpacks containing survival necessities. And as a town, Seaside has set up the Tsunami Supply Barrel Program. And this program has provided 119 barrels containing medical supplies, water purification systems, emergency rations, tarps, and radios. These barrels were distributed to homes of citizens living above the tsunami inundation zone. They provide enough supplies to support 20 individuals for over 3 days. Our town also runs monthly tsunami warning systems that play beeps over speakers. So we are aware, and some of us are prepared to an extent that could get them to a safe zone. But what we are trying to do is make sure that the children of Seaside are taken care of and take a lot of the if out of the survival equation by trying to get our schools moved to higher ground. That's the gist of this. If we move our schools, the survival rate of school-age children will dramatically rise and casualties will be significantly lower. The fact of the matter is that this disaster is inevitable and it could happen at any time. Within 44 years, we will have surpassed 85% of all known intervals. There are no correlations or consistencies among past Cascadia events. That is why it's so important that you're all aware of the procedures that must be taken and the evacuation routes to be followed in this event that they would occur. The procedure for a Cascadia event goes as follows. Duck and cover under a stable structure, such as a desk, table, or worst case scenario, a doorway. As quickly as possible, evacuate to high ground in accordance to your location at that moment in time. It is important that you do not go back for any personal belongings and try not to help other people because you have such a short amount of time to get to higher ground. If you do not know where the given evacuation route is, of the location that you're in at that time, then simply run for the nearest place of elevation that is over 70 feet. And then here are the evacuation routes around our city that we take.
So at the beginning of the school year, our Associated Student Body office sat down and wrote down goals for our school and our community. But due to extreme importance of this issue, we had made the ASB Tsunami Project our national goal. Our student group is raising funds to help spread awareness and help relocate the school district's at-risk campuses out of the inundation zone. We want the nation to know the importance of this issue, and we need to reach beyond our community to do that. As students who attend a school in an extremely risky location, we want to work towards raising funds to relocate all of our schools out of the inundation zone. If we move our schools, not only will that make students safer, but it will act as a place for the community to go when disaster strikes. Depending on the amount of funds we raise, we would like to use that money for earthquake-resistant foot and car bridges, emergency radio communications, natural disaster preparedness kits, such as we talked about earlier, pre-assembled food and supply kits outside the tsunami inundation zone, advertising about evacuation routes, and immediate disaster relief. We are reaching out to you today to help reach that goal. We are also in the process of reaching out to Fortune 500 companies, celebrities, and politicians. Awareness equals preparedness, and we need your help to accomplish that goal.
And how can you help? You can do so by either helping to raise awareness for our cause, or even being willing to become educated yourself and being willing to talk to others about this event. In your community, you could look into possible disasters and how prepared your town is. Because this isn't just a coastal issue. When it happens, as we pointed out, everyone will be affected. It wasn't until we took the initiative as student leaders to better understand this event that we truly realized how unprepared our community was, but this also the state and the entire Pacific Northwest coastline. We felt the need to educate ourselves and anyone who would listen to help us make a necessary change to save lives.
Thank you.
A couple quick summary points just to bring it back to the reality that they face.
We know that the buildings that they're in are going to collapse. They have been structurally evaluated by structural engineers, and they will collapse. Getting out is going to be very, very difficult. Even if they can get out, they're trapped, and they will not make it to high ground. The one piece that has been interesting with this group is this group, there are two presentation groups. The actual group is made up of about, 11 students. And they started asking me questions, and they basically said, as elementary students, we didn't know what we know now, and you probably kept that from us. And then in the next breath, she said, and you're probably keeping stuff from us right now because you're afraid of what this means. And I said, yes. And I started explaining some of these situations to them. For instance, what we know right now is that over the past 10,000 years, there have been 41 Cascadia subduction zone events. We know that the average, and nothing geologically works on averages, but would be that a Cascadia event on average would occur every 240 years. It's been 316 years since our last one. And I know that geologic time is a difficult thing to fathom, but if you look at the time space in between Cascadia subduction zone events over the past 10,000 years, that Chris Goldfinger has been able to identify specifically when these have occurred. We know that we have surpassed, as of today, 75% of all of those possibilities. And by the time these students are my age, they will have surpassed 85% of all of the possibilities that have occurred in the past 10,000 years. And so time is of the essence. And we are going for another school bond. Our previous one, as I reported last time, did not pass. We'll be going for one this coming November. And as I mentioned previously, one of the things that our community, as we go out and speak to them, they ask, how can we do this ourselves? And they're looking for any state or federal help in offsetting the cost. And if that is not possible, just having the support of this committee as we move forward would be tremendous as well. And with that, we answer any questions that you might have.
So that video that you were playing, was it 25 minutes or something close to 25 minutes?
23.
But so that, and that was the time it took to get to the 78, yeah. I assume.
But that was sped up.
So you're
for
about
this.
10 minutes short.
But the real time is on the corner, so that's how long it actually took us.
Right. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So I probably didn't catch. What's the student population?
Of Seaside School District, it's 1,550 students.
Okay. And that's so, and it's which schools specifically, though? You've got three of, or they're all in, they're all
in. We have four schools in Seaside School District. Gerhard Elementary, Broadway Middle School, and Seaside High School are in the tsunami inundation zone, no higher than 15 feet in elevation. Then there's Seaside Heights Elementary that is right at 70 feet.
That's kind of.
And that's, yes.
And real quick, so I'll follow up. So population of those three schools per school, I'm assuming your high school is your bigger population.
Yes, the population of the high school is about 475. Gerhard Elementary is about 300. Broadway Middle School is approximately 350, somewhere around there.
So, we built new school in our district. It was elementary school. They built two of them. They were $26 million each, so not inexpensive. And so my questions to you around building are, what would construction costs look like? Where would those schools be sited? And have you thought about alternatives? And when I talk about alternatives, Tualatin School District has a high school that is not in a traditional building. It's more in a retail space. Kids come and go at their leisure. You know, it's a, there's teachers on site. They are also doing online, so they're open at 8 o'clock in the morning. They go to 9 o'clock at night. You know, something like that is a temporary measure for your high school. You know, what other sort of alternatives are out there? Because that's, a high school is certainly going to be a lot more to build than an elementary school. I can't imagine what it would take to get that done. But, you know, theoretically, you're looking at somewhere close to $100 million to build three schools. If you have the land, and that doesn't include land cost, if you had the land banked, or so, do you have land?
We do not. And Representative Parrish, the piece that most people don't recognize is that this, we basically are Cannon Beach, Seaside, and Gearhart. And about 20 years ago, I went to 25 years ago, I went to the city managers and I basically said, you know, I need to site schools in a higher location, and then that's what brought us. We basically commissioned DeGommy to do it to see how high the inundation levels were. But the cities of Cannon Beach, Seaside, and Gearhart do not have land in their urban growth boundary that is high enough. And that's a major piece. And so finding land, we would have to, we have looked at, we've been in discussions for about 12 years with Weyerhaeuser that owns the property directly to the west, or to the east, that is high enough. And we would have a consolidated campus that's by far the least expensive, but you are not far off. When we looked at relocating all four of our schools, it was $128 million. And so you're really close on the price.
So the question I have then, so you mentioned that you don't have land inside your UGB. Is how, if you expanded that UGB and got an exception for schools that are high enough above the level, how far out does that put your kiddos on a bus riding to school in the morning? I mean, is there reasonable land if you had a UGB expansion?
The actual land that we're looking at is right up against Seaside Heights Elementary School, and so it would be one contiguous campus. Okay. And so it's right there, wouldn't be any further than they're currently.
If you couldn't get that piece of land?
If we cannot get that piece of land, we are, that's basically, we had the whole, from Cannon Beach through Gearhart, that whole hillside evaluated with core drillings, and that one piece of ground was the one that they said was structurally in the best location to relocate the school district.
Representative Escobar.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Did we not pass a bill that wouldn't allow schools to go out past the urban growth boundary to acquire property or to build a school, I think? Didn't we do that about 6 years ago, 8 years
ago? Before my time.
Yeah, I'm not aware. We've had several conversations with DLCD and others on the issue of urban growth boundaries and whether there's a process in which we can speed this process up, and also especially in relationship to the coast and contiguous or not contiguous. And there has been some efforts to make some exceptions, but it's still... It's still a lengthy process, and there has to be findings, and part of the problem are the findings from a standpoint of contiguous in that. But this last session, we had some conversations around Seaside in particular and others, and tried to understand better those issues. But we haven't done anything that actually improved that process very substantially. We changed the law in 2013 around urban growth boundaries, but it did not resolve this situation.
Correct.
I would think that we should check that out, because if there's a statute standing in the way, even if you get your property, it wouldn't do any good. So let's find that out, and we can maybe craft next session a bill to put an exception on the coastal area.
Well, as you know, we're talking about a bill right now that makes an exception for housing, a bill that's being considered this session, in order to promote an opportunity for low-cost housing. So we're already talking about something that would create an exception, so it seems reasonable to me that we'd have that conversation.
I want to circle back to the alternative option. I mean, it certainly changes a kid's day in that it's not a traditional high school model, but I have to say, I mean, I think Tiger Twelton is running maybe 150 kids through this model right now. What they're finding, of course, is that they're trying to find other ways for kids to get activities. because it's not a traditional school. It really is about what fits the child's schedule for a lot of different reasons, whether it's a child on an accelerated path or a child who's, you know, maybe struggling. They've got some couple teen pregnancies in that mix, but they've got some students who are really just trying to bust out their high school and move on in life too. But it is in a space that is maybe not even 3,000 square feet. It's in a retail type shopping front. It does have an online component to it. I mean, is there, are you having discussions around like what else could high school look like besides a traditional brick and mortar type model?
We would if it wasn't forest land. The only land that is high enough is trees.
It's your height.
Right,
so even your retail spaces and
no. The retail spaces we have are 15 feet and lower.
Okay. All right.
And so but it's a great thought. And so we're open to any discussion. But unfortunately, it's forest land.
Okay. That's in the boom.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, there is no building in anything that's higher. That's the problem. The whole town's there, and including all the housing, et cetera. It's a big problem. But so as depressing as this is, I still keep a little bit of an uptick in it in that we will eventually get that. The talks with DLCD have been very, very productive. We've got the time frame down, I think, and I've heard 35 days from start to finish. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but we've been doing this for a long time. But the big deal is this is a super important. You guys are the best advocates, I think, yes, you know, yeah. Right now. And I have all hope that when we run this ballot measure, this levy in the fall, that they will be able to prevail, because you will have done all this work and convincing people it's very necessary to do. On top of that, I see it as, you know, if you have to convince people further that there are more things more important than you guys, which that's debatable right now. But it is important to note that this is a big jobs program. All this building, I mean, that's a lot of money, that's a lot of jobs, that's a lot of keeping our economy going, and, you know, we have a lot of people who could benefit from this work. And in this time that, you know, it's not happening, we'll have like a community center and space that we can use for other things, as well as the school piece. And I think it's an opportunity. It's a kind of a bad reason for an opportunity, but it is a good opportunity, and I'll do all I can to help you. And we have the group, the OSPAC group, Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Council, who includes a lot of people who have been working on this for a long time, and they're just excited that somebody's out there doing something very, very actively right now. And we all want, finally, I'm almost done here, we all want to make sure that when you get, and if you get, George Clooney, I do get a 5-minute with him. That's all I ask. Thank you.
So I'll make a couple of comments. So when we spoke last time, part of the issue from the standpoint of the state funds, we've set up programs to help school districts retrofit buildings for earthquakes and damage like that. The program does prevent money to be spent on moving or rebuilding new. I've had some conversations with leadership in that. It's the intent that we will introduce a bill for the upcoming session that would change that, to allow the funds that were, allow other school districts to retrofit those buildings that aren't in an inundation zone, that those funds could be used to supplement local funds to help build new buildings in a zone that is safe. As I've talked to people, it was never the intent, nobody thought about this particular circumstance when we did those, thought that by retrofitting buildings we would take care of everything, but that's just not true. It doesn't make sense to retrofit the buildings in Seaside. That's right. So it'll be the intent. I don't know who this committee will be or the chair, but we'll work on that, so when the session is ready to start, that legislation will be ready to introduce. It won't help you in the short term, but it might help in the longer term.
But we do have a little precedent setting that was very valuable. It was FEMA. Has always been an after-the-fact expenditure.
Yeah.
You have to have a disaster, and then you get your FEMA funds to fix things. So we finally got it to the point where they're willing to consider preventive measures, and this exactly is that. It falls into that. We also got, I think it was $10 million that the president just gave to some of these. There's a bunch of money coming down. I hate to even put numbers in it because I'm not sure of them, but... we've got the federal congressional delegation's attention, and we're very lucky in my district, in which you are inside, Congresswoman Bonamici, and I think she was just speaking at your school.
Yeah.
And she's very supportive, has been from the beginning. And, I mean, I talked to her about it. She goes, relax, let's talk about something else. I'm there, you know. She already has educated herself, and she's open to more education. So don't give up any. If you have anything new, keep pounding away at all of us, because we can always learn for more. So I think the precedent's been set, and I think that a lot of things from other agencies, federal agencies, there's possibility of funding sources that, you know, you never can give up. So,
Representative, please.
Chair Lively, thanks. I just want to acknowledge this group. You came to Gresham High School, which is my high school in my district, and appreciate very much. Had hopes through the superintendent that you would be able to come back here because you are the best advocates and the best salespeople around this. The presentation keeps getting better and better as you continue to work on it, but so keep it going. We have really high expectations for the bills that our chair spoke of. So you were heard. And but it wouldn't have happened if you hadn't have come to Gresham. So at least that aspect. And again, as I said to this committee, it was so empowering to see the young people from, you know, quite a distance, having to get up very early to come and do this presentation. Just, again, this is the generation we educate. This is the generation that's going to make the huge differences for us. So welcome to your capital. It's great to have you here.
And thank you, Representative Peluso. I remember now that you were the one that alerted us to this, so thank you for your efforts, too.
No problem there.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on a personal note, have all of you had your families be prepared? Honestly. I can tell by the look on your face.
I think a lot of families in Seaside
aren't prepared for this event, but mainly because they don't really know about it. That's one of our goals, too, not just to move our schools, but to spread awareness, because before we really started this presentation, we didn't know what was going to happen until we started researching and realizing people are going to die, and it's serious. I have not yet talked to my father about it, but it's a serious problem. I have family all throughout Seaside that need to know about this.
And you are correct. People will die. People will be hurt. But my big concern is the million homeless. How are they going to take care of themselves? Because the government can't come in and take care of a million people. So there must be some self-preparedness. In fact, I passed out a thing. Yeah. I was hoping we'd get him up here because this individual is all about personal preparedness, because we're going to have to take care of ourselves, because the government will be overwhelmed, literally overwhelmed, because you're talking from the coast clear to Interstate 5. You know.
Representative Huffman, did you have?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. You guys did a great job, and I hope you're getting extra credit or something.
Ice cream on the
table. I'm not going to put the superintendent on the spot here and ask necessarily, but hopefully you're getting
free lunch.
But now, you know, hopefully you guys will take back the sincerity of Representative Esquivel's question, because it's incumbent upon each of us to make sure that our own house is taken care of, our own family. And if you could instill that to all of your classmates at every level of the spectrum, pre-K through 12, you know, so that every student went back and says, hey, Mom and Dad, we need to be prepared, that will make, I mean, think of how many thousands of people would be affected and impacted by that message. So very, very good point about, you know, go back and talk to your family and make sure that cousins and everybody
preach
are prepared.
Okay, thank you. And thanks again for coming. You are absolutely, you can be more effective than most of us adults in carrying this kind of messages. So we really appreciate your taking the time. And I assume missing some school, maybe. But thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay in touch with me, too, because I want to help you. And we have to keep him busy.
That's right, so he can't retire, huh?
Well, he can retire, but then he can go full-time on this.
The only reason I'm retiring, if you don't mind, just one quick thing, is so I can spend more time to pass this phone.
Okay, very good.
So that's
good enough.
Reason, honestly.
Sure.
Oh, and we also have some blue ribbons that we would pass out after the session. Oh. That we will explain more about it.
Okay.
You want to tell them what they go out?
Okay, so where are we?
Oh, you're the chair.
Well, I'm here.
Okay, still. Well, we have a few more minutes, so we're going to now move on to.
Well, this last.
Oh, did I miss somebody?
No,
on this. I got everybody, didn't I?
Yes.
Well, thank you, Vice Chair Boone.
I was just passing along.
We're now going to have an informational meeting on aging Oregon veterans.
They going to put my picture up there?
Mary.
It's a poster job for aging.
And Mr. Chair, as Mary comes up and is not joined by Cameron or Mitch, but Mitch is back there for moral support, I wanted to do a shout out and thank Mary and Mitch for traveling to the Dalles and meeting on veterans' health issues. And I was stuck here, but really appreciate you guys going and visiting with the area aging folks and the VSO and others. Thank you.
And we'll be following up with you to do another meeting in May.
Very good.
Another opportunity.
Thank you, and
so
welcome.
So thank you for this opportunity. I'm Mary Yeager, for the record, the Aging Veteran Services Director for the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs. And as you've heard...
Not that you're aging.
Not that I'm aging.
Okay. I wanted to clarify the title because it almost sounded like...
Yeah.
So Cameron Smith is unable to join us this afternoon. He's in D.C. at a meeting. Mm. So either I'm here to... because he actually trusts me to do it alone, or as one of my coworkers this morning said, I'm here to walk point for the commander.
Okay.
Okay, so a little bit about Oregon's aging veterans. 331,000 total vets in Oregon. 331,000. Over half are over the age of 65. Mm. And in fact, 54%. Right? So for an agency that has been around 70 years, many of the veterans for whom this agency was founded are still alive and either still living in the community, some are in the veteran homes, and many others are in other levels of care. So I am not a veteran. I'm married to a veteran, so I'm a spouse. So I'm new to this veteran world. I'm about a year into the agency, but I'm not new to aging. And having previously served as the long-term care ombudsman for Oregon, so about 40,000 people live in licensed long-term care, we can bet that certainly of the males, more than half are veterans, and then we can think about their spouses and families that are impacted. Those are just folks in licensed care facilities. Like most Oregonians, veterans are still living at home. Maybe we see 6% come through some other level of care. So I know you have a number of veteran issues in front of you, but even people like me who have spent most of their career working around elders, the notion of an elderly veteran and those specific needs are new and continue to emerge. So I think you all know that we have two veteran homes. One built in the late 90s in the Dalles. Newest one in Lebanon. And frankly, the newest in the country and a model, not only because of its care, but because of the way it's laid out and specific staffing. So I think you all know those, both those buildings are not staffed by state workers. They are subcontracted through a nonprofit. But unknown to you, and certainly it was unknown to me, the agency also cares for what I'd call its third home. So 250 veterans are under the care of the agency for conservatorship and for representative payee. So in the non-veteran world, out in the DHS human services world, we would call that preventing institutionalization, right? So we have a small but mighty group that literally, but for their intervention, they are keeping these veterans out of, certainly out of the veteran homes, but certainly out of any kind of long-term care. And I, for one, didn't know that, and I don't think most Oregonians know. If you look at that population, those needing conservator conservator or representative payee services, that is a pocket that is going to grow. As more and more people stay at home longer, may need just a little bit of extra help, certainly paying your bills. If you don't pay your rent, mm-hmm. if you don't pay for your utilities, what is the fastest way to get on the slippery slope to long-term care grid, right? So I wanted to bring that to your attention. Also, just a little bit about the agency. 70 years old, about 80 FTEs, they are some of the nicest people on the planet. And I'm not, hello everybody who's watching. I'm not saying it just for them. I've spent, as I said, a lot of my time around human services, and you can tell the minute you walk in that door that the people who work with veterans are there to work with veterans. The vehicle just happens to be through state service. They are really some astounding souls that kindly deal with people's problems every day. And if you look at our aging population, those who have PTSD or undiagnosed PTSD, as they age, as the potential for dementia increases, the opportunity for things to go wrong can happen very, very quickly. So I just wanted to put in a word for those angels who are out there and working for our great state of Oregon, serving our veterans. I wanted to close with not the story, but a story. Can we have our picture of our World War II veteran? So this is Dick Lavette. He is both World War II and Korean vet, and this is with his permission. But when I started this job about a year ago, I met Mr. Lavette at the Oregon Nursing Home in the Dalles, the Veterans Home in the Dalles. And he asked if he could take me to his room to introduce me to his history as from his service in the Army. And so I got to meet his wife. His wife's picture is one of 387 women who were graduating as RNs, so her beautiful Army picture. I met his daughter, literally only a picture of his daughter. And he said to me, you know, don't call me a hero. The heroes didn't come home. And despite the fact that he was tortured, left for dead, tossed in cold water, actually a river, that brought him back to life, he said, that is nothing. Coming back here to lose your wife and your daughter in the same year, that's tough. That's one of those sentences that I know I will carry with me the rest of my career. Someone who so honorably served, decorated, Bronze Star. He is 100% service-connected. One of the cutest guys you'd ever want to meet. Maybe he's a men's size medium, tall, but quite mighty. When he asked me what my job was for ODVA, he just could not find a place for the fact that I'm not military. I report directly to the commander. Now, how would that work? So asked me a few more questions and walked me back to meet Cameron in the lobby and said, you know, I've hired a lot of secretaries in my day. And I could see Cameron's eyes getting kind of big, and he said, you know, this gal, she is a keeper. So just want you to know I've got the blessings of at least one World War II veteran. And I also just wanted to point out that is a new putting green we have at the Dalles. The plantings haven't been done around the back, but all you got to do is look at the smile on his face and see why it matters to a veteran. So I'll close with my little statistics. I'm glad to take any questions if you like. Sir?
Sure. Questions? I have one. So we have the two homes, one in the Dalles and one in Lebanon.
Yes.
So what's the current opportunity for residents? I mean, are they full? Is there still opportunity that people could... somebody could end up there? What's
so,
the status?
So, Chair Lively and committee members, Lebanon is about two-thirds full. Okay. Frankly, right now there is a waiting list for the dementia unit.
Okay.
And as staffing increases, the rest of the houses are being full. If you haven't had a chance to visit, it is a very unique model. Mm-hmm. Several buildings, we call them neighborhoods, so it feels very much more like, really like a hotel or... a high-end family home. It's very non-medical, no medical carts in the halls. Feels much more like, literally, you're on a very long weekend. The veterans love it. Private rooms, floor-to-ceiling windows. If you know what a Hoyer lift is, so for people who can't move, mm-hmm. in the ceiling track, there's a spot where you can hook the Hoyer lift so a veteran can be moved from bed to the bathroom to the shower and back doesn't sound like a big deal until you've had to either need a Hoyer lift or help someone in it. And certainly for the longer-term nursing staff, I mean, that is an incredible invention. Yeah. But to be admitted into those two homes, you need to first meet the criteria of Medicare. So if you were able to, as a non-veteran, get into another skilled facility, that's the level that the federal VA uses.
Okay. And the DALS?
The DALS runs pretty full. I think our bigger opportunity there is what we are calling a refreshed. And while it was built to, you know, phenomenal stats when it was built, there are two-room units. I mean, certainly most Korea and definitely Vietnam vets tend not to want to share rooms. So we are in the process of putting together the request to the federal VA to have that brought into the new world.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Boone?
And I almost forgot it. Okay. Would you be willing to give the committee a tour maybe sometime?
Oh, we would be honored. We'd be honored to
really
have you come for a tour.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you come to the DALS, one of the things Mr. Levitt said to me yesterday, and I said I reminded him I was going to share his picture, and did he have any requests to send along to the committee? And he said, yeah. Tell them hello and come on out and visit.
There we go.
But there are some really incredible souls there, both living there and working there in both of our homes.
You. Would you let the rest of us in, Representative Huffman?
Well, Representative Witt came out with me one time, and so I suppose if he could, we could certainly make room for Rep. Boone.
Okay.
Thanks. Can I just say something about Mary? I just think we're so lucky to have you in this capacity and in the last capacity, any capacity, as long as you want to work here. If you need anything, I will be here to help you.
Oh, you are.
I agree, even if she's aging. I agree. I think I would talk to Cameron about the title, though. Anything that starts out with aging.
That's good. No, I'm a keeper.
You're a keeper, though.
Oh, that's right. That's
and
right.
And you're not a secretary.
There you go. That, yeah. Exactly. But thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Anything else? Great.
I'm afraid to say anything about aging.
Yeah. Thank you, Mary, for coming and testifying.
Thanks.
Certainly.
We'll be looking for your support as we learn more about what the needs are across Oregon. Thank you.
That's great.
And may I just say one more thing? It's kind of a weird little connector between these two presentations, but my husband's father he's gone now, but was a World War II vet, and he designed the Seaside High School. And the thing like that, where that was very innovative in its time. It's the waves, you know, because the beach, the waves. Anyway, I hear about that all the time from, you know, the family. And said, well, remember, you know, what would Dad think? And I said, I think he'd appreciate the fact that it needs to be moved now.
He probably would. Representative Escobar?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to remind people as well that it's not just the veterans, but the veteran spouses that are also eligible for benefits. And if you know of someone that their spouse had been in the military, they need to go to their local VA and find out, their veteran service officer, and find out if they are in fact eligible, which they probably will be.
Great. Anything else? Okay. Again, thank you, members, for a good short session. I don't think we have anything left on our...
We're finished, aren't we?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, we have no more bills in committee, and you could consider closing the committee and meeting at the call of the chair in the future. Given the long floor sessions and chambers.
Yeah, that's what I think the intent will be. But
are there any bills that we might want to get in step at the
Well, there's several. I don't know if our committee could do it, but yeah. Again, thank you, committee members, for your service, and I look forward to whoever is on this committee and next year. But we have legislative days in between that we'll have some chance to tee things up for 2017.
Cool.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tee things up for 2017.